Okay, everybody, hello. Welcome. Friday, 5 p.m., WHBC 90.3 FM, time for American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. I'm here every Friday at 5 p.m. with Heidi Morales Ryan.
This may be the only time you hear me.
My trusty co-host. Yeah, I speak a lot. I talk a lot on Fridays.
Yes.
Mike Tejan, our engineer, is in the house. We are back live, of course, today, and we are going to get back on track. Fridays, we like to discuss the...
How music changed.
Exactly right. And today we are going to present the first part of what we consider to be our show number 130. Believe it or not, we got 250 of these things.
Oh, jeez.
We jump to the beginning, and then we jump to the middle, and we're going to work our way.
Like a sandwich.
More like two sandwiches moving away from each other at the same time.
Oh, okay.
We're going forward in each case.
I thought it was the other way.
But today, for show number 130, we need two parts to it. We're going to cover the life and times and work, of course, of Mr. Phil Spector. Phil is actually, it's going to be very interesting how this unfolds, because I realize that this story is going to be one like almost classic in its telling, where you're going to have pretty much the rise and the fall. And show number one, this first show, which we'll consider show number 130A, will cover the rise of Phil Spector. And this show will end with Phil at his peak. We'll come back next Friday. We'll continue with the show, starting with exactly where we left off and bring us to where we would be with poor Phil in the year 2007.
Oh, geez.
But let's start at the beginning, the humble beginning, although it's not so humble if you end up with a number one hit. Here's Phil Spector and his very first band, called the Teddy Bears, with To Know Him Is to Love Him. Record producers come and record producers go, but very few have a vision that is so unique they become more famous than the artists with whom they work. Phil Spector definitely falls into that category. In the early 60s, he stood the recording industry on its head by implementing changes so profound that popular music would never again be the same. For one thing, he proved that with enough capital and a string of successful releases, he could operate with absolutely no assistance from major record labels. That was unprecedented, since virtually every independent label before him had relied on the major labels for, at the very least, distribution. Another factor, which is very important to understanding Phil Spector, is his disregard for economy, both financial and artistic. Spector was born and raised in the Bronx, But his father passed away when he was living there, and shortly thereafter, his family relocated to Los Angeles. When he was in high school, he formed a band called the Teddy Bears, that's who we were just listening to, with a couple of schoolmates named Marshall Lieb and Annette Kleinbard. Spector played a little bit of guitar. He sings the background vocals on that track. The lyrics, he based the song on the words that were inscribed on his father's tombstone. He wrote, "To know him is to love him," and it became, very surprisingly, a number one hit. It wasn't even the A-side as he had planned it. It turns out that there was some record distributor in the Northwest somewhere who got the single and was ignoring it like every other radio station was at the time. And then, as so often happens in the history of rock and roll, flips it over, liked the B-side. We got enough requests for it that all of a sudden there was an order for something like 15 or 20,000 copies of the record. Spector thought it was a joke, and he called up pretty much to presume that it was a joke to find out if it before they went ahead and manufactured them, but found out that it was quite real. And in no time at all, the record began to catch on, and very soon he had a huge hit on his hand as a songwriter and a performer. Well, empowered by this newfound fame, he then lobbied for and he won the right to produce an album for the group. In the process, he met two people that would be very important in his life, one being Lester Sill. The other one was Lee Hazlewood, who were the producers responsible for people like, say, Duane Eddy. And he was working for them for a while. They trained him in the art of production. And considering, if you know Duane Eddy's sound, how it's so drenched in echo and it's all filled with all these different effects and everything, it was very easy for Spector to get enamored with what they were doing in terms of effects and how they could turn something relatively simple into something that sounded absolutely huge. This is kind of what Duane Eddy did. Well, he studied the techniques of these two guys, Lester Sill and Lee Hazlewood, for a while until he pretty much felt that he was ready to move on. He found out that there was an opening or a chance for him to work in New York with Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, two of the most famous songwriters at that time that you could possibly imagine. They were writing huge number one hits for the Coasters. They were writing hits for Elvis Presley. They were probably in the late 50s, early 60s, probably the most famous songwriting team going. Really up there with just about anybody. Well, they had just gotten a job writing for the Drifters, Lieber, and producing for them, which was a bit of a change for them because most of their songs were a bit, hokey would not be the right word, but they tended to be humorous. They tended to like play rock and roll and humor, and the Drifters were not about that. Mm-hmm. The Drifters did a lot of ballads, and they were much more serious. Yeah. So after a while, Lieber and Stoller realized that they maybe could use a little bit of input. Well, along comes Phil Spector, and he has some songwriting abilities, and now he has some production ability. So he starts working with Lieber and Stoller. The first thing, and this is just an amazingly remarkable coincidence, he starts working with Jerry Lieber, and they actually wrote a song together as a Lieber/Phil Spector song. Here it is, released by the Drifters, probably one of the most classic songs of all time, Spanish Harlem.
Thank you. watch her as she grows. In my garden
there is a rose in Spanish
Harlem. La, la, la.
There's Benny King with Spanish Harlem. Now, I had mentioned that that was the Drifters. That was a bit of a mistake on my part, because this was the time when Benny King was breaking away from the Drifters, going solo, but still some songs were released with the Drifters. And if you think about it, I mean, it was still the exact same label, the exact same production, the exact same everything was involved. I even believe that the background vocals were the Drifters. So it really was just a matter of how the song was credited. But technically on the label, that song is credited to Benny E. King. I'd like to mention, it's also interesting, we are discussing how music changed. Today, our show features Phil Spector, which is very interesting because as an influential person, he's one of the very few people that make my list who is a non-performer.
Right, a non-artist. Well, can't say artist because he is an artist at what he does.
Exactly right. But it's also a bit contradictory because as this show begins, he is technically an artist and literally an artist. Although that is not exclusively why he's, as you will see as the show goes on, of course, why we are featuring him. For example, he is playing and singing and writing the song To Know Him Is to Love Him, the first track that we played by the Teddy Bears. And now at this point, he is working rather steadily with Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, with the Drifters and Benny King and all the stuff that they're doing. And he is meeting some of the most incredible songwriters of the time besides them. He's also meeting Doc Pomus and Mort Shuman, Jerry Goffin and Carole King, Cynthia Mann and Man
He's making
and
all the connections.
Even Burt Bacharach. All of these songwriters are now becoming a part of his world, and he's moving in this circle, and he's even getting work as a studio musician. He's also, think about it, guitar.
Oh, okay.
In fact, let's play the next track. Believe it or not, a track that eventually was made famous by another guitar player has the first guitar solo actually played by Phil Spector. Here are the Drifters with On Broadway. Check out the guitar solo now. That's Phil Spector playing lead guitar.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always when you're walking down that street,
credited to the Drifters, that is On Broadway, with guitar played by none other than Phil Spector. I find that interesting because it became a huge hit for guitar player George Benson something like 15, 20 years later
on.
So I just can't help but wonder if it somehow, if you could have been inspired to recognize it as a guitar tune based upon Phil Spector's playing.
Well, maybe he didn't even know. George Benson might not, he probably didn't even know when he decided to do it.
That's very possible. That is absolutely possible. But it's then it's even more of a coincidence that being the case.
Yeah, right.
You know? I want to remind you, you're listening to American Hit Network on Friday when we do our How Music Changed edition. The station is WHPC 90.3 FM in Garden City, New York. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, with Heidi Morales, Ryan assisting me, and Mike Tejan as well, running the boards and keeping me on track.
You said I was fired.
Never going to happen.
That's okay. Okay, good.
Well, we're continuing with Phil's story now. We have to move on. Now, he is getting to the point where he has now proved himself well enough in the Lieber-Stoller camp to start getting some of his own work. So they start giving him some assignments. He started writing, producing songs for Ray Peterson, Curtis Lee. He did Pretty Little Angel Eyes, a track that you probably know as a hit. For Gene Pitney, he recorded a track called Every Breath I Take, and it scared everybody to death because he spent $14,000 to record this song.
Ouch. Yes.
And we're talking about in around 1959, 1960, that was a huge amount of money.
He kept on a budget.
He had no economy mind whatsoever. It didn't matter to him. If he wanted an orchestra, he got an orchestra. If he wanted a chorus, he got a chorus. And he would bring all this stuff in.
And he had it all catered.
And the studio people would really balk at the label, like, this is too much money. But everything he touched turned to hit.
Gold.
He had the Midas touch. So when you spend 14 grand, but you make 10 times that,
You
can't complain.
Right.
So the labels basically said, okay, we can't argue with success. One of the songs that he produced that led to this opinion, let's play this now if we can. Here's one of the original solo productions by Phil Spector, one that eventually led to his forming his own record label. Here is Ray Peterson with Corina, Corina.
I love Corina.
Oh,
there, of course, is Ray Peterson with Corrina Corrina, one of the original solo productions by Phil Spector, another one of his, just in a series of hits that led him eventually, knowing nothing but fame, he decided to return to California and form his own record label. And when he did go back to California,
what was the name of the label? Do you remember?
Phyllis. Phyllis, as in Phil Spector.
Catchy.
And what he did was he went back, and remember the two people that I said he originally learned from, which was Lester Sill and Lee Hazelwood?
Uh-huh.
Well, he brought Lester Sill as his partner.
Uh-huh.
So it was Phil and Les. And they put out Phyllis Records. Now, they needed to find some product and see what they could come up with to see if they could have some success on their own. And the Crystals were among the very first product that Spector hired. And he immediately produced two top 40 hits for them. The first was called There's No Other Like My Baby, and the other track was entitled Uptown. But idiosyncratic, to say the least, and independent, Spector decided that he no longer wanted to work with Lester Sill. So he gathered up as much money as he could, borrowed all that he could, and bought Sill out so that it was totally Spector's project now, completely, 100%.
Hmm.
He then went ahead and he hired the best talent that the West Coast had to offer. Although it cost him a bundle, he was now at a vantage point from which he could conquer the world. And like Napoleon with the recording console, he started to do just that. When the profits from those first two hits fell far short of what he really needed to pay back all of the debt that he had incurred to buy the label and to hire all these musicians, and also to enable him to pay the Crystals, they began to grow very suspicious of what Spector's intentions were. They were not in a position to change anything, though, since Spector controlled virtually every aspect of their career, including the name, the Crystals, that was owned by Phil Spector.
Oh.
Ooh.
Matters got worse when the next thing that he did was he insisted that they recorded a song that was written by Carole King and Jerry Goffin, a very strange masochistic song called He Hit Me, It Felt Like a Kiss.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good song.
I remember that song.
It was a very interesting but very weird song. And, of course, with a topic like that, it made it very difficult for it to become a huge hit.
Kind of like Hit Me, Baby, One More Time.
More or less, but in the 60s when it was very politically difficult.
Of course.
They did put it out, though, and it did become a minor hit, but not as huge as what it could have been.
Right, not the hit that they were expecting.
Exactly. At this point, the Crystals had become totally alienated by this pop Svengali called Phil Spector, and who apparently had absolutely no regard for their opinion. But Spector apparently could not have cared less. It meant nothing to him. He soon after that caught wind of a Gene Pitney composition that was called He's a Rebel, and it was just about to be released by a singer named Vicky Carr. You might remember her who sang It Must Be Him. I've never heard her version. Thank goodness for that. That's okay with me. But Spector decided he'd try to beat it to the punch, so he had to go into the studio to rush record his own version with the Crystals. Unfortunately, though, he didn't even bother to tell the band, the Crystals.
Oh, boy.
They were out on the road. They were touring. So instead what he did was he called in a group named the Blossoms, which featuring Darlene Love. He brought them into the studio. And since he owned the name, the Crystals, he released it and credited it to the Crystals.
Oh, that's funny.
The result? A number one hit. It's called The Crystals. It's actually Darlene Love and the Blossoms. Here's He's a Rebel.
Proud.
Now imagine if you were one of the original Crystals and you're on tour
and you're hearing
singing
this song?
Your previous hits, and all of a sudden you're hearing that your new number one hit by the Crystals called He's a Rebel, and you never heard the song before, and your audience is now yelling it out and requesting it.
Yeah.
It was absolutely incredible. This is what happened. You can imagine the Crystal surprise when they learned they had a number one hit record on the charts that they never heard. They needed to learn He's a Rebel in a hurry to accommodate the fans who were asking for it.
Oh,
this
wow.
wasn't easy, though, because if you listen to this song, first of all, the phrasing is really tight. It's very wordy. And Darlene Love, who is singing lead on that track, has a lot of gospel experience. She's more of like a gospel singer. And you hear that
yes.
ad-libbing that she's doing at the end. That didn't come naturally to the original Crystals. Now, the thing is, now this gets even more crazy. It didn't do him any favors that he didn't tell Darlene Love the truth and the Blossoms the truth either. They didn't know that the record was going to come out credited to the Crystals. So now it was their turn to complain. So now you see, since they don't even know what's going on.
Complaints fall on deaf
that's
ears,
great.
Though. I have a feeling.
Spectre just could care less. It didn't matter. He just says they were starting to complain to him now, saying, wait a minute, we recorded
awesome.
The song. What did you credit it to them for? He says, you know what? Then I won't use you anymore. I'll go back and I'll get the original band. So he goes back and he rehires the original four girls who were the Crystals to come back into the studio. By the way, I should mention their names just for history's sake. The original Crystals were Barbara Alston, Mary Thomas, Pat Wright, and D.D. Kinnebrew. Now, and Lala Brooks as well. The thing is, though, as I'm saying these names, you know, they're the Crystals, but do you think of them? I mean, you ever even heard those names before?
No.
These are Phil Spector songs, you know? It's just the way that history
right.
that's great.
Handles this.
That's unbelievable.
Well, now he has another song. That this one is written by Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. And he calls in the original Crystals again to get them to sing the song under their own name. You think the record business was sexist in the early 60s? Or at least
holy
you think
no.
Phil was?
Right.
My God, incredible, isn't it? Well, here are the original Crystals with To Do Ron Ron. You know, when they were recording that song in the studio, Phil Spector kept asking the musicians, is this song dumb enough? You think it's dumb enough?
Dumb enough?
He wanted to be sure that the song was dumb enough
like
to appeal
kind of thing.
To the kids.
Like bubblegum.
Right.
It was very important to him because he figured it needed to have kid appeal.
Kind of like Holla Back Girl.
And yet it's, well, yeah, but then again, you think
sorry.
About you think about the appeal of a song like this, where here it is more than, I mean, this was a hit in May of 1963.
And then it was a hit again for like Leif Garrett or one of those
guys. I think
you're
right. It was Sean Cassidy, I believe.
Oh, Sean Cassidy.
I think it was,
yes.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I'm sorry, I keep on doing this, but Do a Diddy Dumb, kind of like that, kind of like the same kind of...
That probably was exactly what he was going for, although this predates that. So he was definitely onto something. The thing is, he has these producers. This is a good time as ever for me to mention the band. Phil Spector had brought together a bunch of musicians that he called the Wrecking Crew. This is what he had invested in that cost him so much money.
Big
and
money.
And if we I'm just going to drop some of the names of the people that were recording with Phil Spector in 1963 on these hits. These, by the way, are the same people that eventually went to work with Brian Wilson when he was recording Pet Sounds.
Same
group of people. Brian Wilson was very enamored with Phil Spector, so he hired everybody who Phil Spector was utilizing for his own recordings. But the players included, well, guitarist Tommy Tedesco, who is credited as being perhaps the most recorded guitarist in history, for being on so many tracks.
Wow.
Glenn Campbell was a regular guitarist on all of these tracks.
I didn't know that Glenn Campbell worked with Brian Wilson, too.
Yep, absolutely. He even replaced Brian Wilson on tour for a short while as a very temporary member of the Beach Boys.
He's certainly cute enough.
And there you go, back in the
is he chubby enough?
In the early 60s. On saxophone, all that saxophone playing is usually Steve Douglas or another guy named Jay Migliori. But the people whose names you would recognize, the keyboard players alone, are Leon Russell.
Wow.
Mac Rebinac, Dr. John.
Big names. Wow.
Incredible. The drummer is Hal Blaine. Carol Kay is one of the only female bass players in the whole studio session work. Maybe not ever, but certainly there aren't many. But you know, her legend is enormous.
Right.
Conductor and arranger, he had Jack Nietzsche working with him. And Sonny Bono is helping with arrangements
and coming in
and conducting everything all at the same time. At any one moment, and he had other people to play percussion, all sorts of different things going on. I mean, Phil was one of those guys who actually considered like a castanet to be an integral item in a rock and roll recording.
Right.
So in his studio, he'd have something like it could be 30 people at any given moment. Well, anyway, getting back to what we were just talking about.
Yikes.
The other thing, of course, Phil's expending all this energy on girl group records. And by changing the crystals back and forth, it really caused an awful lot of confusion in general. I mean, in 1962, 63, girl groups were all the rage. And by Phil Spector changing band members, it just added to the confusion of how many bands there were out there. But ultimately, it didn't matter because, as we had pointed out earlier, it wasn't really about the artist. It was about the sound. And Phil Spector had the sound. And in 1963, it's absolutely no doubt about it, the mastery of his domain was complete. He was going to do a little bit more work with the Crystals, but his eyes at this point and his heart were focused elsewhere.
Uh-oh.
We'll play one more track. Here's Phil Spector with the Crystals once again. This track is called Then He Kissed Me.
He walked me home.
They called it the Wall of Sound.
Right.
And it's pretty obvious
infamous
why.
Now.
Just absolutely huge amount of instrumentation, and the sound that he had got was unprecedented. Nothing else was ever like it before. Now, it might be difficult today to understand exactly what makes that so special, because I could see a lot of people thinking, well, anybody, if you have the money and you have the ability, the access to this much talent, maybe it's just a matter of being able to afford it. You bring in great players, you give, you know, 20 or 30 different players parts, and you just record it with a little bit of echo, and voila, instant, you know, instant hit. It was not that easy, to say the least.
And it was in mono, too.
Well, he eventually mixed it all down to mono. He did start with what I believe was a 3-track board. And the genius of what he did was he would take this entire rhythm section, all of that that was going on, and figure out how to dump all of that sound onto one single track. And then he would use the remainder to add on strings, horns, and the vocals, just by intelligently figuring out how to cross dub. And after a while, listen, you only got 3 tracks to work with. You've got to be good. You've got to be really good.
Right.
And I mean, obviously, Spector had an innate understanding of overdubbing methods. And by doing it better than anybody else, this was pretty much what caused him to have these results. But he was, by the way, as I was implying earlier, well, first let me mention, you were listening to American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. On Friday, we like to discuss how music changed. This is what we consider to be show number 130, part one.
Or
A.
Part one / A. We need subsets for this now. It's gotten that crazy.
Roman numeral one, A and a half.
Exactly. There's so many of these. We like to. We were discussing Phil Spector, and this is the rise of Phil Spector. And I was mentioning before the song began that he was getting tired of working with the Crystals because he was distracted. Well, I don't know if this is true or not, but one story says that Estelle, the sister of Ronnie, Veronica, actually called up Phil Spector and was trying to get in touch with him. The other story was that she was on the phone and ended up, through having a crossed line, getting connected to Phil Spector. Well, anyway.
Wow.
Speaking with Phil Spector, Estelle Bennett, was speaking with Phil Spector and arranged for an audition. Now, at this point, Phil was so tired of this whole nonsense that's going on with the Crystals, both of them, that he just wants to move on. So he says, yeah, come on down for an audition. He takes one look at the three sisters, and he's immediately smitten with Veronica, Ronnie, and he knows he's going to sign them. The fact that he's a married man is absolutely irrelevant. This man is going to make this woman a star.
Yeah.
And he decides to go full bore at everything that he can possibly do to get Veronica under his wing in just about every possible way. In fact, he originally intended to sign only Ronnie, Veronica. He wasn't interested in the rest of them. Well, her mother would have no part of that. Absolutely not. Phil Spector had to meet with Veronica's mother, and she said to him, well, you're going to take the group. And he says, no, let me sign your daughter. I guarantee you, if you let me sign Veronica, I will give her a number one hit. And the mother's response was, you're going to give all three of them a number one hit. The three of them being Veronica, of course, her sister Estelle, who made the phone call, and their cousin Nedra.
Wow.
And these girls already had some experience singing. Yeah, right. Go mom.
Yeah, totally.
They had already performed. You know, they had these cutting contests that were going on in Harlem every night at the Apollo Theater. They did perform at the Apollo, and they came out alive. They did not get booed off of the stage, and that is a tough crowd.
That's tough, yeah.
So they survived it, and this was pretty much without any real material. Their look was incredible. At a time when hairdos were the fashion, these girls had these beehive hairdos that probably caused problems with airplanes.
It's like a rainforest. It's like a rainforest in there.
It was just absolutely incredible. I'm sure that flight patterns were disrupted all over New York City
like
when these girls walked down the street. They were also fairly famous for became featured performers as dancers at the Peppermint Lounge. So they were reasonably well known. But now they become, quote unquote, the property of Phil Spector.
Ouch.
Like he did with the Crystals, he now decides to own the Ronettes, brings them in, and now does the same thing in reverse. Only now, the Crystals are totally ignored. His focus is 100% on the Ronettes. And he started writing hits or actually, excuse me, producing hits for them, taking songs that were written by other people now, and because of his production, he is now taking a songwriting credit on every single thing he touches. Wow. So if Phil's producing it, he's also got a songwriting credit on the song. There's no denying, though, in my mind, that he deserves it when a track sounds like this. This is one of the most astounding produced tracks probably ever recorded in the history of music. Here are the Ronettes with Be My Baby.
Amazing how much the Beach Boys took from this, isn't it? You can hear their sound coming out of these songs.
Absolutely. Between the last track and this track, you can just see that Brian Wilson was absolutely enamored with the sound and then studying it. What I love about that track more than anything is that drum sound in the beginning of the record. It doesn't even sound like a drum set. It sounds like he brought in explosives and set them to go off. And
boom, boom.
Just absolutely incredible. Now, the other thing that's very interesting about this, I mean, and I think it's fair to say this, Veronica or Ronnie, you know, she had a voice that was far from classic, especially at that time, but it was instantly identifiable. Her sound was very reedy and it had that really unique timbre to it, but that was good because it allowed her to project her voice above the din, which was obviously necessary for a Phil Spector production.
Right.
And it's funny how things turn out, too, because the Ronettes' lasting popularity has since made Ronnie Spector's voice classic by definition.
Right.
You know, it just is. Phil Spector also, interestingly, missed out on his promise to Ronnie's mother when he said that he would guarantee a number one hit because Be My Baby was stopped at number two.
Wait, but so was that going to be the song for Ronnie?
Yeah, well, that was it. That was it. Came out, of course, as the Ronettes.
Right.
But, you know, listen, it stopped at number two, but listen, it's like horseshoes and hand grenades. Close enough counts. That was a big hit. The Ronettes became stars. The problem was, though, Phil Spector's growing obsession with Ronnie soon caused him to make certain that their chart history would be short-lived.
Ooh.
This is true. You see, like I said, despite the fact that he was already married, he was totally head over heels in love, and he was determined to make Veronica a star at first, and he lavished his attention on her. Like most of the things in his life, Spector's nature toward her was all-consuming, and she was flattered to be the focus of a man who she considered to be as worldly as he was, especially when she saw the way that he handled the recording sessions for Be My Baby. So she was totally enamored with him as well. The problem was, now that she is getting so much attention, jealousy begins to set in. And now Phil is not so sure about whether or not he wants to let her be the star that he had already decided to make her. And now he's already setting in motion plans to see if maybe he ought to end her career before it goes any further.
And it's kind of funny that it's Be My Baby is the name of the song.
The next track is more or less a continuation of the same story, a track which is probably just as good. But isn't it interesting, I think, that this song would have stopped at number 24, a song as incredibly powerful, and it's obviously could have been a number one hit. And I wonder if Phil did a few things to prevent this song from becoming as famous as it could. Here are the Ronettes once again, this time singing Baby, I Love You. There, of course, is Baby, I Love You by the Ronettes. Like I said, stalling at number 24. Seems very strange. I guess what happened here at this point, I think Phil Spector was beginning to, A, become very protective of Ronnie, and also he began to think that maybe he should stop working with girls. Maybe it was time to get away from the girl group sound. For another reason as well, the Beatles hit. Think Baby, I Love You was entered the top 40 in January 1964. So if it enters in January 1964, what else happened in January 1964? The Beatles hit.
Yes.
Everything changed. Phil had a good idea about exactly where he was going to be at, and there was time for a change.
I want those Beatles.
We got time for one more track by the Ronettes, so let's play one more before we say goodbye. Here's Walking in the Rain by Veronica Bennett and the Ronettes.
Thank you.
made some beautiful music together for a while.
and then they had to get a restraining order.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it was obviously it wasn't very great for Ronnie. I mean, she married Phil, and he had very deliberately dismantled her career. And then it was only a matter of time before, you know, his worldly nature became a suffocating vacuum, and he has her, like, locked in the bowels of his mansion behind an electrical fence and an iron gate.
Ew.
Wouldn't even let her out in public. They did eventually divorce in 1973. But 10 years before then, in 1963, Phil Spector was considered to be almost like a musical god. He recorded in an album, a Christmas album that came out in December of 63. It wasn't a big hit when it came out, but it has been revisited every single year since. And I think even today it stands as perhaps the single best rock and roll Christmas album, pretty probably untoppable. So as absurd as it is, you can't really cover Phil Spector without playing this track. So we're going to end this show with a track from the Phil Spector Christmas album. And meanwhile, we will be back next week with what we'll consider to be the fall of Phil Spector.
Part B.
Tune in for that part B or part two, or whatever, of show number 130. A show that's going to actually happen to feature a number of songs by the Beatles, both as a group and solo. So
let it be.
Hope you tune in for that. Meanwhile, thank you for listening to the show. I'm Tom Ryan with Heidi Morales Ryan, Mike Tejan. The show is American Hit Radio here Tuesdays and Fridays. We'll see you next Tuesday at 5 p.m., next Friday as well for more Phil Spector. Meanwhile, here is Darlene Love, remember her, with Christmas, Baby, Please Come Home.